Accession number 17681, reel 4.
Colonel Robbins, reel 4.
When the 43rd Division left the River Seine and motored right up through France and Belgium, Brussels, we were going very fast, following up a retreating German army. Everyone was full of hope, and as I said a little earlier, we arrived in Belgium and were then told that this great operation, Market Garden, was about to begin. We felt very pleased that we were involved in this operation, which very briefly meant the capture of three bridges, one at Grave, one at Nijmegen, and a final one at Arnhem. The final one was being done by the 1st Airborne Division, General Browning, the other two by American Airborne Divisions. 43 Div and the Guards Armoured were due to go right through across these bridges and get to Arnhem, relieve the 1st Airborne, and then our division, the infantry, were already given orders to go and capture three widely separated towns on the River Rhine. I forget them. Ours was Deventer. I forget the other. And it was very exciting. So, off we went, and the march was becoming a bit tiring. As we got into Belgium and Holland, there was definite signs of German resistance. We realized we were on a narrow one road, one axis only, leading from Grave, where we rested, right up to Nijmegen, where we found the Germans were resisting strongly. The Guards Armoured were fighting them and had a very hard fight. We were waiting to go through them and cross this bridge. Twice the Germans tried to blow it up. They blew up a railway bridge. The Guards Armoured and some very gallant American airborne troops went across. The Americans, by unreliable boats in many ways, but they went across and they were slaughtered by machine gun fire going across. All this taking part while we waited to get across that bridge or get across the river. The Irish Guards led. They went across somehow. The Grenadiers were clearing up Nijmegen. And eventually we were ordered to go across the bridge, which still had dead snipers strapped to the girders, shot dead by this time. Dead soldiers lying all over the place. It was a grim assault. The Irish Guards had gone across, and as they went across, so they came onto a very narrow raised road, and that road led straight to Arnhem. It wasn't far. What happened then was that the Germans, who had sighted their 88mm anti-tank guns and their own tanks at various places, shot the Irish Guards off this raised road. That meant the infantry had to go in, and we were told to get on as fast as we could. Not, of course, up the road, which was under very heavy fire, but through the fields. When I say through the fields, this meant through the dikes. I always joke about myself being quite tall, where I'm not really. And I said, well, luckily some of us were quite tall enough to get through these dikes without being drowned. In my case, the water came up to my chest. And at various dike sections, there were quite often a machine gunner, German machine gunner. So it was a hard fit, and we lost a lot of men. All the time, the divisional commander was saying, get on the infantry, get on. And this was going on with several other battalions trying to get to Arnhem. Eventually, the 4th Wiltshires got to a place called Elst on the main road. And we had to fight for that, of course. Lost a lot of people, but we got in there and we got our gunners up the church tower, good OP. And my own company was ordered to take up a position, first of all, on Elst railway station, where we fired a captured railway, a German captured train. To our astonishment, inside it was full of the most desirable goods in the way of clothing. Underclothes, fleece-lined boots, socks, fleece coats, clearly for the Luftwaffe or somebody. And we didn't loot the place, but we did help ourselves to some of this. I made sure the brigade commander had one of these delightful coats, and my commanding officer and all my major friends. And I tell the soldiers they were not loot. They could put in their packs what they could carry, i.e. a pair of gloves, a pair of socks. They couldn't, because they had to, we knew we'd have to march. I was able to put a coat because I was a lucky man with a jeep. And that was the picture of it. Eventually, the Germans were still trying to recapture this. We were told to push on, and my company did push on and took up a position a mile or two north of Elst. It was this one side of the road and railway line which run parallel and close to each other. The Germans were by then resisting us quite hard. And I remember taking up this position, and again it was in ditches and dikes. But we lined one side of the railway line, and I had chaps right up to the railway line at night. Certainly the Germans were the other side, and we could often hear them. They made one or two attacks against us, we repulsed them, and so on. One morning, the Germans were heard conversing. One of my corporals came back and said, it seems to be there's quite a few of them on the other side of the railway line, i.e. about 30, 20 yards. They had been shouting things in. 4 a.m., 3:30, 4 a.m. this was. I went from my headquarters, which was about 30 yards back, I went up to the front to see what was happening and took with me a sergeant and a couple of other people. I had to get onto the railway crossing. I went there. To my astonishment, looking down the other side into the ditch, I saw, 50 or 60 German soldiers lined up, bayonets, ready to come across, presumably at first light. It wasn't quite first light then. So, my sergeant was very quick. He threw two phosphorus grenades into that crowd. Another chap with me fired his submachine gun down it. I, being a very good infantry officer, didn't have any weapon on me, so couldn't fire anything. I had my pistol, I suppose. And that was a good start. The German soldiers put their hands up, and we pulled them out of that ditch. I and a subaltern and a couple of people went forward beyond these men who were being captured, to try and find, I couldn't see an officer, a German officer, try and find. We did. About 20 yards back, we found the little company or little headquarters, in which was a German officer and two or three people. They put their hands up. I said, "Don't," to my chaps, "don't shoot. They've got Red Cross armbands on." The chaps put their, we came up to them. I looked back over my shoulder, saying, "But still, take them, because I can see one's an officer." I turned back. The officer had pulled down his hands, pulled out his own pistol, and fired at about 3 yards range, if that, into me. I had a thick leather coat. I had my Sten gun by this time. The bullet struck my Sten gun, took off the top of my finger. Some went through my coat into my side. I was bowled over. My subaltern rushed up, filled this man with lead, and I don't know what happened, but I went back to my headquarters saying, "Capture them." A very nasty story, because in fact these chaps were Panzer Grenadiers, I think, had put on the Red Cross armbands for protection. They were not Red Cross men. That was a war crime. I said, "Well, we shot him." I went back to my company headquarters, which was just across the railway line, and my sergeant major gave me a pull of brandy, and I did my hand up, and I hung about, wondering what to do, when to my astonishment, some of my soldiers brought a figure covered with blood in back to me and said, "This is the officer who shot you, sir." I said, "But I thought we'd killed him." "Well, he's not dead. This is him." So my sergeant major, who was a very gentle man as a rule, said, "I will take him over the hedge, sir, and kill him." By this time, a lot of us had cooled down. I had cooled down. I said, "Do not do that. Certainly not." And the long and the short it was, I said, "I've got to go back to the RAP to have the doctor look at me. I'll be back soon. I don't feel I should go away. I'll put this chap on my jeep and take him back." They wanted to make him walk back, because by this time they were very angry with him, taking his boots off and so on. Anyway, I got him back, and looked this, to cut a story short, 7 bullets were taken out of this man, and because of my report, he was put down as a war criminal, having surrendered, wearing Red Cross armbands, and then pulling a pistol, etc. And I forgot the matter, and that was that. Little did I know then, that a year after the war ended, I was suddenly to be told to report to Wuppertal in Germany to give evidence against a German captain who had shot me, dressed as a Red Cross man and having first surrendered, and to bring the witnesses. The witnesses were my sergeant major, my second lieutenant platoon commander, that brilliant sergeant who got a military medal before and who was killed. All these witnesses had there been shot or died of wounds. It was just me and one other soldier, I think, left. And I went down, and the long and the short was that a British artillery major wearing a military cross defended this German. A man from London came out to prosecute. A man, I may say, who was in the Army Legal Department, who appeared to know absolutely nothing and care even less. The German public were allowed in the balcony to listen to this, one of the first minor war crimes. And the long and the short of that is that I was told maybe it wasn't quite light enough for me to see that this man had not put his hands up, to see that maybe I'd mistaken the Red Cross. There you are, I had no witnesses living. And I recounted the story of how the sergeant major said, "I can take this man and shoot him." I said, "No, maybe we should have done." Gasps of surprise from the German public. Anyway, that was that, and I went forward a year. We finished.
What happened to the man in the end? What kind of sentence did he get?
He got away. He got away with it completely.
Do you know the date of the incident when he shot you?
Yes, I do.
What was that about?
October the 7th or 8th of 1944. And this trial took place December 45.
And where did the incident take place, the shooting?
North of Elst. On the so-called assault up to Arnhem, which we were trying to get to. And that was a nasty incident.
Were you hampered in functioning as an officer through the wound?
All I had was my arm in a sling. My right arm in a sling. My injured finger, which you can see here, top shot off. And I was shot with a pistol, so it didn't really wound me badly. And I remained at duty because we were short of officers, it was quite unnecessary for me to go away. Anyway, we were relieved next day, by a company of the 82nd U.S. Airborne Division. And the major came up and spent the night with me in order to get the feel of it, because the Germans, of course, were still around. I told him the story of the railway line incident. He said, "Well, we're not going to put up with that. If the Germans are over there and they've come back into this orchard there, we're going to push them back 150, 200 yards. I said, "Fine." We have been going backwards and forwards a bit. I went away. A very nice man. His chaps padded in, I remember. Very accomplished-looking paratroop soldiers. And I went back into reserve. Strangely, I said to my driver, "Where is my fleece-lined coat that I looted from that train?" He said, "I think you left it in the trench up at the front." I said, "Well, we'll quickly drive back there. It's only a few miles. It is daylight, and we know exactly where to go." I went back a day later. To my astonishment, the American company that we had handed over to had been attacked that night and driven back 200 yards, having told me they were going to drive the Germans back 200 yards that way. Needless to say, I never got my coat. But these incidents do stick in the mind. And that was that. From there, we went into the Reichswald Forest, and dreadful place where there were patrols and much less grim fighting. I think the German troops in front of us there were not up to scratch. I think they were sick men, a lot of them. And from there, suddenly, we were ordered to go secretly right down south to the area of Aachen, Geilenkirchen, in order to take over from the 43rd Division, this was, from an American division. Because we were going to have an assault through the Siegfried Line, which was there. And so the war went on for me. We got there. I remember having to put on an American helmet to do reconnaissance forward. They were a very young battalion, hadn't had any fighting. And it was very interesting to see the reaction of the American soldiers. It's a nasty thing to say, but they said, "We don't often see our officers up in the front like this." Very funny. I didn't quite get that. But then we relieved them, fighting very close. We were quite close to the Germans. We could see where they were. They could see where we were. Very nasty, very muddy conditions. Winter had already set in, late November. And one day, my excellent colonel was up in my front line with me, my second-in-command, Captain Crisp. We were standing, looking towards the enemy, and suddenly the enemy opened fire with tank shells, anti-personnel, which they fired into the trees above us, and they burst and showered shrapnel downwards. My captain made a strange sound and fell into me, into my arms. I was hit in the eye as if by a tremendous blow with a baseball bat. And we both fell into a trench. The captain's head practically came off in my arms because a piece of shrapnel had cut his throat from ear to ear. I myself didn't know what had happened to me, but I was in pain in my left eye. I looked for the colonel. He said, "I have not been hit. It looks like an attack. I will be at battalion headquarters," and that's the last I saw of him, because quite rightly he went where he had to. Tanks rumbled about. I was the only officer left in my company then, alive. So I had to stay, although I was told to go back. Eventually someone came to relieve me about 12 hours later. The German attack we expected did not come in. I went back to the battalion headquarters. They looked at my eye, the office. I was sent back to the dressing station. Someone had a look at this. They said, "You have got..." And my eyelid seemed to be pinned down by a safety pin. Painful. And they said, "You'll have to have an operation. Somebody's gone into your eye." I was sent back to Louvain. The doctor operated on me, said, "I may save your eye. I may have to cut it out. I don't know." Well, I woke up, and he said, "Luckily for you, it was an 88-millimeter shell that exploded over steel. I have taken this shaft of steel out of your eye with a magnet. Here it is." It was about half an inch long, gone right through my eye. And he said, you'll be blind, I expect, in that eye. But at least we didn't have to cut it out. So that was the end of my war, because I was sent home.
Where and when did that wounding occur?
On the last day of November 1944. And I got back to England at about... I went back to Brussels Hospital. They sent me back to England. I went to the hospital at Swansea. They let me out at Christmas. But by that time, and I'd been to various doctors, they said, "Well, you're lucky. Lost most of the sight of this eye." And I wondered whether it would affect my career in the army. I was then sent on a bit of leave and then sent to various headquarters, low medical category. I asked to go back to the battalion and had a great deal of difficulty. Eventually a friend of mine which is the way things happened in those days, said, of course, you can go back, and fixed it somehow. And I was ordered back to the 4th Wiltshires, who by now had gone into Belsen. And somehow I was sent out to rejoin them. The battalion had gone into Belsen, not as the 1st Infantry Battalion, because when this place in northern Germany had been found, to the astonishment of the British troops, who were being led by armour, who were on their rush towards the towards what they thought was Berlin, they came on this concentration camp, which was something no one had ever conceived before. First, the stench of thousands of dead, decaying bodies. Then the astonishment of seeing these gruesome skeletons walking about, or lying about, and the armour charged into the camp and said to these people, you are free, and released them. And then the armour was ordered on, and then the following infantry came in. The point I mention that is because had medical advice or wiser advice been present, those exultant soldiers who'd gone in first would never have let open those gates, because what were these people to do wandering out of the gates? Where were they to get food? The men's prison was one thing, the women's prison were loosed. Men and women had never seen each other for years, and there was the inevitable shocking incidents which resulted in dead male and female lying around, we found in the woods. When the soldiers did give them food, they gave them the wrong food. They ate so much their stomachs burst. It needed medical attention. This is where the 4th Wiltshires at this stage seemed to come in. And we were ordered to, with our flamethrowers, to burn down a lot of these huts which had been occupied by these poor people, concentration camp people. And also, we got hold of the guards and made them dig long trenches which could take 20,000-30,000 bodies, and shovel these bodies. There was no question of finding out who they were. They were sent to get rid of, and the Germans were made to do it. A nasty business. And those are the sort of stories that lingered. I did not see much of this because I got back and my company was stationed about 3 kilometres outside Belsen, Hohner, in the town of Bergen, Belsen.